Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
There is a group of Americans that are angry about taxes, frustrated over the possibility of universal health care, and furious over what they call the excesses of the stimulus package. And they don't care who agrees with them.
The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests. The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus.
It's no surprise that the Tea Party movement would echo the themes of economist Milton Friedman, but they're also borrowing from Saul Alinsky, the Black Power movement, and pro-choice activists. Not the silent majority, but the loud minority rules for the radical right. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 4th. The takeaway for me is that we've seen a lot of huge protests since the days of Saul Alinsky. A lot of people taking his advice. What makes one movement succeed and another fail is the question.
And Saul Alinsky and Milton Friedman, both from Chicago. We called him Uncle Milty when I was at the University of Chicago.
Did you?
Yes, indeed. Let's get right to the top stories we're watching this morning. Another pothole in the road for Toyota. Just a few hours ago, the company announced there are design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius, which went on sale last year. There have been 140 complaints in the U.S., mostly from drivers who say they temporarily lost brake power after driving over a pothole or other uneven ground. As for the recall, yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said investigators are looking at more than just mechanical gas pedals in Toyotas.
We've had some complaints about the electronics in these automobiles, and that's the reason that we're going to look into it.
Earlier on the program, we spoke to Ken Basinger, an investigative journalist for the LA Times, who told us the recalls are an indication of much bigger problems at Toyota.
Toyota, lots of times, just like any automaker, finds problems. The difference is Toyota quietly fixes them and doesn't tell anybody.
Journalist Ken Basinger from the LA Times. At a global news conference this morning, Toyota estimated the total cost of the recall will be as much as $2 billion.
The first Tea Party convention kicks off in Nashville, Tennessee today. The group grabbed headlines last year with often highly charged protests against President Obama's health care bill and stimulus package. Joining us now is Jim Tomasik. He's a steering committee member of the Mid-South Tea Party near Memphis, Tennessee. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Can you tell us why you joined the Tea Party? You joined about 10 months ago.
Right. We kind of had the Tea Party thing started here back at the beginning of last year, and a lot of us are just feeling like we've lost our seat at the table and our country is heading off into a direction that we don't want to see it go, and we're looking out for our children and we want to pull it back to the center.
Okay, Jim Tomasik, stay with us. We're going to talk to you more in just a moment.
A new report shows healthcare spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. It's the biggest one-year jump on record. Americans spent $2.5 trillion on healthcare last year. And in 2 years, the government, if trends continue, will be paying for more than half of all healthcare in the United States. Two bills on Capitol Hill to talk about this morning. The bipartisan Senate bill introduced today will give businesses tax breaks for hiring unemployed workers, and the House will vote on whether to raise the cap on federal borrowing to $14 trillion.
Moving overseas, intelligence officials now say the leader of the Pakistani Taliban was killed in a missile attack last month. He was responsible for a wave of suicide bombings, including the attack on the CIA base. In Haiti, 10 U.S. missionaries face charges for trying to leave the country with undocumented children. They'll appear before a prosecutor today, and he'll decide whether to press charges in that case. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down, as are futures. The Dow will start at 10,270, the S&P at 1,097, and the NASDAQ opens at 2190. Later this hour, we're going to talk to an author about her creative process in dealing with grief over the tragedy in Haiti.
Sure, you're political, but do you have a platform?
My own political platform would be an emphasis on comprehensive or supplementary education. The health care, I'm down with that. Would want to make sure that's on the platform. And just kind of a fundamental respect of others.
Takeaway contributor David Wall Rice getting in on our project this morning. Found a political party, give it a name, and tell us your platform at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Tea Party's already taken.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. We've heard the words Tea Party a lot lately in the news, and we're talking about a group of engaged citizens, often very articulate and informed, who are angry over certain things that they feel the government is doing wrong, and they want to change them. Has that been helped or hurt by the engagement of senators and partisan politicians and by the news networks that are covering them? We're going to find out when the Tea Party Nation convention kicks off in Nashville today. The event is a little troubled, and it may not entirely be successful at unifying the various individuals that make up local tea parties. We have a local tea partier with us this morning. Jim Tomasek joins us again. He's from near Memphis, Tennessee. Good morning again, Jim.
Good morning.
And we have Professor Tom DeLuca, a professor of political science at Fordham University, who studies political movements and parties, author of a forthcoming book called Change We Can Count On, Political Equality Now in the USA. Good morning to you too, Tom.
Good morning.
So, Jim, the Tea Party Convention begins today. It's hosted by the Tea Party Nation founders Judson and Sherry Phillips. It's only about 200 miles from you, but you decided not to go. Why aren't you going?
Well, we don't feel like it's representative of what the Tea Party movement is about. It seems to me to be a Republican Party fundraiser, and people saying that this is the face of the Tea Party movement, well, I think they're very mistaken.
Well, what's your issue with it? I know I've heard complaints over the fact that it's a for-profit organization now, and that Sarah Palin's being paid $100,000 to speak. Is it the money that's involved that's bothering you, or its connection to the Republican Party?
Well, it's the connection to the Republican Party foremost, because some of the organizers said that the money that would come to it would be funneled to candidates that they, the Republican candidates that they wanted to see in Congress or whatever office they're hunting for.
So, Tom, these kind of issues that occur when a grassroots movement begins to become nationally organized, is this relatively common?
Yes, I think it is relatively common, because what you have going on is once a movement is in its infancy, people don't pay much attention to it. But once they demonstrate that they have following and clout, then, of course, established political leaders try to make use of the movement. I think that's what we see going on right now.
And Jim, that's your problem, is when established political leaders are trying to make use of your movement.
Well, exactly. Tom hit the nail on the head. You have people running out there trying to get out in front of this thing and become the face of the Tea Party movement, when the Tea Party movement is in itself just people standing up, the common person standing up and saying, wait, this isn't right. Well, you know, Dick Armey running out there with his Freedom Works and trying to get out in front of the parade and trying to hook up with Tea Party patriots and having this stupid contract from America, you know, that... We've already done all that Republican Party stuff, and it didn't work. We've got to figure out a way to get around all this money and get these people out of the way and get our voices heard at the table.
Well, Jim, what are your issues? I mean, there's a lot of different, very separate individual concerns among people from Tea Party's organizations in different states. What are yours?
Well, first and foremost, I've been doing some of this for years. I'm an advocate for the Fair Tax Act, which would return power back to the common citizen and take it away from the lobbyists in Washington, D.C. It turns over our income tax system and replaces it with a progressive sales tax or consumption tax type system. And, you know, that's one of my pet goals, but... Really, all of these things, like what's going on with the health care reform, people aren't paying attention. Even my own wife wasn't paying attention, and she's like, well, why are you working so hard on all this stuff? And then she gets a letter in the mail. She's a retired postal employee. She gets this letter in the mail, and they're explaining, well, if the health care legislation passes, you have a Cadillac health care plan, and they are going to tax you on this amount of money. And she's only getting a small pension, and the amount of money that she's going to be taxed rips a big old hole in her money that she wants to live off of. So now she's going to have to go back to work, because the federal government decided to screw up 85% of us to help 15% of us. And, well, that's the kind of thing that's really aggravating me and making me want to stand up and scream.
Tom, this is really common where you hear particular people who have particular issues that are individual to them, that have a personal significance, and then when you try to coalesce that into a national movement, not everybody has the same concerns because they are such personal angers. The anger or frustration is the same, but the issues in and of themselves are not the same.
That's right, and it's very difficult to pull a coalition together. But, you know, facts are important here. So one of the things that we see often with these movements is people are reacting to change in the world. They don't know what to make of this change, and so they react to it. So these movements tend to be, and historically, reactionary in that sense. They're reacting to changes that they don't quite understand or can't really move beyond. So, for example, Jim just mentioned this question of the Cadillac insurance. Facts are important. Only 10% of Americans are in unions, like the postal workers. Therefore, it's absolutely impossible that this kind of so-called Cadillac tax would affect 85% of the American public. But because someone cares so passionately about it, he takes one fact and he blows it way out of proportion to describe a whole political universe, which just simply isn't true. So it's very important, opposing some of the kinds of things that government or lobbyists are doing, to really get the facts right so you can zero in on exactly the right things that are really hurting you.
Well, you know, to step away for just a moment from the fact-checking of the Tea Party movement, which could take a long time, but what separates something like the Tea Party movement from, say, all the protests we saw during the Bush administration? Is it the fact that they have a major news network covering all of their protests? Is it the fact that you have buy-in from politicians?
Well, no. I think the issues separated. I mean, the anti-Bush protests were more from the liberal or left side. These are obviously from the right or even extreme right side. So I think that's one thing that separates it. But what unites it is this feeling that the political world has gotten out of control and is not responsive to the people. That's why I think it's so important for people on the left, the right, and the center to really understand that we've really got to develop a political system that has far greater political equality. I'm not talking about social and economic equality, but actually political equality, the ability to actually have influence in Washington and in the state capitals.
That's Tom DeLuca, professor at Fordham University. John, Jim Tomasik, that sounds like exactly what you want, a seat at the table.
Well, what Tom just said just totally twisted what I said. I did not say that 85% of the people were covered by the 85% of the people were covered by the Cadillac plan.
Jim,
that's not true at all.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to continue with that particular one, though it is a good conversation for later. Jim Tomasik is a member of the steering committee for the Mid-South Tea Party near Memphis, Tennessee. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
We may not have been more healthy than ever before last year, but there was a record 17% of the U.S. economy spent on health care last year. Meanwhile, yesterday, President Obama urged Senate Democrats to focus on getting health care reform done.
So many of us campaigned on the idea that we were going to change this health care system. And we said we were going to change it. Well, here we are with a chance to change it.
For now, healthcare legislation remains stuck in legislative limbo. Overseas, Pakistani officials say they have arrested 35 suspects as part of their investigation into a bombing that killed 3 American soldiers in northwest Pakistan yesterday. We've also learned the suicide bombers specifically targeted those American troops. The death of the 3 soldiers has drawn attention to U.S. military assistance inside Pakistan. The soldiers were part of a mission to train local forces to fight Islamic extremists near the Afghan border.
Across the border, the U.S. and Afghanistan troops are planning their largest joint offensive in the Helmand province in the south. Back at home, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has rejected Iran's offer to swap 3 American hikers detained in Tehran for Iranians being held in the U.S. But she says Iran should still release the hikers.
They should do so on humanitarian grounds, since the detentions of our citizens is baseless.
Clinton called the allegations against the hikers unjust. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up next, listeners have a lot to say about one of our most controversial segments ever, the military's potential repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. A lot of opinions out there, most of them articulate, all of them strong.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway, from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
An extended takeout now about some news developments out of Pakistan that are significant this morning. We're joined by Marvin Weinbaum, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Good morning, Marvin Weinbaum.
Good morning.
So let's talk about the two headlines this morning. First, the U.S. apparently now believes that the Taliban's leader in Pakistan, Hakimullah Massoud, is dead. And we're getting details of the attack on a convoy that killed three U.S. soldiers in the northern Pakistan that certainly has raised the issue of what are U.S. troops doing, training or otherwise, inside Pakistani territory. Which do you think is the most important, Marvin?
Well, actually, over the long run, anything which disrupts the activities of the Pakistan Taliban will have great effect. The fact that the Americans were targeted and eventually something like this happened, I think it was something like this was bound to happen, in that the locals knew that there were Americans in the area, even though they were effectively disguised. They were not dressed in uniform. They wore local clothing. But foreigners have a way of standing out.
Well, but it also suggests that the Taliban is so entrenched in that area of Pakistan that they can basically turn the locals, and that no matter how camouflaged they are, foreigners are really not safe operating covertly.
No, nor is anyone safe in that area. Foreigners are kept out of that area. It's a district adjoining SWAT, which got into the headlines last year. And we know that there's a great deal of presence of the Pakistan Taliban in that area. It's called Lower Deer.
Evaluate for us this remark from Richard Holbrooke, who of course is the special U.S. envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan. He spoke about this attack yesterday.
They were on their way to the inauguration of a girls' school in the western area of Pakistan. Obviously a great tragedy, and we are deeply regretful of the loss of life.
Now, he's referring there to a USAID program, which is what this school apparently was. Aside from the regret associated with the loss of life, these development projects are increasingly becoming targets of insurgents, right, Marvin Weinbaum?
Right. What we've been doing, though, is we haven't branded them normally. Many of the locals are not supposed to know that where the money for it is coming. But, of course, if we show up and commemorate its opening, that does suggest a link to the U.S. I think that also we should remember that these were special forces. These are regular American troops in that special category that we have, and they were sent there because the Pakistan Army has refused to have trainers with its own forces, but said, yes, you can go ahead and train this Frontier Corps, which is a paramilitary force, and quite important in putting down the insurgency and sustaining that fact.
What is the political sensitivity likely to be of these three U.S. soldiers found on Pakistani territory doing, even as you say, a job that the Pakistani military doesn't want to do?
Yeah. It's grist for the mill for those who are beating up on the United States on a regular basis in the press, the media generally, who are saying that the United States, with the permission of the government of Pakistan, is permitting them to do things which impinge on the sovereignty of Pakistan. So you could say, though, our standing in Pakistan is so low it can't get much lower.
Right.
And that also applies to our drone attacks.
Which is apparently the modality by which Hakimullah Massoud died, a drone missile attack. Is he likely to be replaced quickly, and is his loss significant?
Well, he will. There are two or three people lined up to replace him. But any time you have a transition like this, it does create questions about the future of the movement. And they're reeling anyway because of the more aggressive approach of the Pakistan Army in South Waziristan, in an area called Bajur. So that this is certainly a difficult time for the Taliban, but they are so entrenched that I certainly wouldn't think that by any means that with the death of any one or more people that the movement is entirely back on its heels.
All right, well, thanks for that. A full briefing from Marvin Weinbaum there, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan, currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute, reporting about how entrenched but still possibly reeling the Taliban in Pakistan.
And now a takeout from our listeners. Our coverage of Don't Ask, Don't Tell has generated a slew of responses. Yesterday, retired Colonel David F. Beattie compared the Army to a gated community.
What most people don't understand is that the military is a pretty cloistered sort of community, kind of like a gated community. It's a lot different than the rest of society. It's much more culturally conservative.
That sparked a response from Bob of Massachusetts.
Apparently, the senior military advisor that was on the show thinks that the gated community is very homophobic. So I think they need to come into the 21st century.
More comments on our website, thetakeaway.org. Yesterday, we also reported that Galveston, Texas, has received some federal money in the wake of Hurricane Ike, but it may have come too late for some beleaguered residents. One listener from Utah thought we were just stirring up trouble.
What are you trying to do? Get the mayor to convince over the fact that relief went to Haiti faster and in larger quantities than it came to Galveston? I mean, are you trying to convey a news story? Are you trying to just stir stuff up?
While Super Bowl Sunday might be exciting for some of us, that's just not so for listener Charlie Marino, who suggested we spend our airtime in other ways.
I suggest that, one, we think whether or not anyone who's listening to your type's radio show would even care about the Super Bowl, and whether or not it's really worth in this day and age to spend time on what kind of food people are going to shove down their throats during this useless and overblown preoccupation.
Why, thank you. I'd be happy to come over for your Super Bowl party. That would be great. Sure, I'll be there on the Sunday at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd love to know, do you care about the Super Bowl or not? Anything you can weigh in on this program at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, it's the week. Who had a good week? Who had a bad week?
Coming up, we're going to talk. Top U.S. intelligence officials say it's highly likely we'll see another attempted terrorist attack in the next 6 to 3 months. 3 to 6 months, should Americans breathe a sigh of relief? We're going to talk about it in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, U.S. intelligence officials briefed Congress yesterday about how vulnerable America is to a terrorist attack. We're going to take a look at that more closely with the Middle East editor of the Newsweek magazine, Christopher Dickey. He's in the studio. We'll discuss it in just a second. But right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Faulty gas pedals. Now Toyota says there are design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius, compounding issues that are hobbling the company this morning. As for the recall on gas pedals, yesterday Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said the government is looking at more than just Toyota's plan to fix those faulty pedals.
It's up to us to tell them if we think that their solution is not correct, and now we'll be doing investigations and studying the electronic part of it.
Toyota says it expects to lose $2 billion from its largest recall ever. A new report shows healthcare spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. It's the biggest one-year jump on record. $2.5 trillion federal dollars were spent on healthcare last year.
Even before that report came out, President Obama told the rank and file in the Democratic Party that there are no excuses for not passing health care reform.
All that's changed in the last 2 weeks is that our party's gone from having the largest Senate majority in a generation to the second largest Senate majority in a generation. And we've got to remember that.
Some positive news for the president. A bipartisan Senate bill will be introduced today that will give businesses tax breaks for hiring unemployed workers. President Obama's aunt will be in a Massachusetts courtroom today to argue that she should be allowed to stay in the country. She was ordered to be deported back to Kenya 6 years ago, but she never left. The president says he didn't know his aunt was living in the country illegally. And a life-sized bronze sculpture of a man by Alberto Giacometti has been sold at auction for $104 million. It's the most expensive work of art ever sold at auction. It was sold to an anonymous bidder by telephone. Was that you, John? Did you?
Yeah, I tried. You know, I came this close.
Yeah. Let's check on the markets now. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,270. The S&P at 1,097. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,190. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
It was a little bit of be careful what you ask for this week at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. Chair Dianne Feinstein asked top intelligence officials this probing question.
What is the likelihood of another terrorist attempted attack on the U.S. homeland in the next 3 to 6 months? High or low?
High or low? Well, which answer do you think Dennis Blair gave, the director of national intelligence? The director of the CIA, Leon Panetta, was also there. And they all did not hesitate in their responses.
An attempted attack, the priority is certain, I would say.
Mr. Panetta?
I would agree with that.
Mr. Mueller?
Agree.
High, low, nope. Certain was their answer. But let's take a look at that and see what the context is for that statement. The hearing that I said was yesterday was actually on Tuesday. Joining us now is Christopher Dickey, the author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. The book comes out in paperback this month. He's also the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Region Editor for Newsweek magazine. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning, John.
So, you know, certain that there will be an attack.
An attempt. And that's what they were talking about. I think you really have to step back from this statement. What they were answering was the question, is there going to be an attempted attack? And as David Cohen, the head of intelligence for the NYPD, says, there's somebody out there plotting to attack the United States, even New York City, every day of the year.
So it's no different than saying someone's attempting now.
Sure,
we think
sure.
There's somebody
there will
out
certainly
there.
Be attempts. The yeah. question is, will they be successful attempts? And that's much less likely. But that was not the question that was asked.
Right, exactly. And the details at the hearing were actually interesting on this overall question of vulnerability. It seemed to me that Leon Panetta and some others were talking about three sort of categories of potential attempts. One being the coordinated 9/11 style attack, right. which it seems to me is a low priority. There was also a discussion of this franchise operation, like the Christmas Day bombing, where a Nigerian is doing the bidding of an organized group in Yemen. But then there was a discussion of clean contacts, so-called individuals with very little connection to terrorist organizations, where they would likely show up on watch lists that have been sprinkled into the United States. Leon Panetta said this tactic is something that they're very, very worried about.
Yeah, they are worried about that. They're worried that there may be little cells, individuals, or more to the point, little cells scattered around in places where people are not very tuned in to the terrorist threat. Out west, for instance, you had the Najibullah Zazi,
right.
was operating out of Colorado, but his target was New York City. You have people in upstate New York. You have people in the Southwest who are being watched very, very closely because there is concern that they have direct contact with people close to Osama bin Laden.
The suggestion of these clean recruits would lead us to believe that there is a pool of potential recruits who have valid U.S. passports or maybe immigration papers, who are you know, clean of any sort of record, who have not been to training camps. I mean, are we also talking about, you know, people who maybe look like Caucasian 12th
sure,
graders?
Sure, there are lots and lots of people who are converts to the al-Qaeda ideology. Not lots and lots, but let's say a few hundred, who are Europeans or European background and who basically don't show up in this sort of profiling that we all know actually goes on. And that's obviously a big concern. You know, if you look back to the early days of the operations in Afghanistan when John Walker Lind was caught.
Right.
If you had John Walker Lind walking around the street today in New York City, nobody would look at him twice.
So what's the countermeasure in that situation when you're not going to be able to track people down and find out what their intent is? You actually have to have a countermeasure that basically stops the attack once it's started.
Well, no. Actually, what you have to do is very aggressive intelligence so that if these people are networking in any way, shape, or form, either on the web or with other kinds of communications with any kind of centralized group, you intercept those communications. You follow that. You also have to try to penetrate these groups. But there's also the issue of loners, people like Nidal Hassan, the guy who shot up Fort Hood, Texas.
Right.
Now, he was a nut. He's like a lot of people who shoot lots of people in the United States of America. But he was communicating with al-Awlaki, this American-born imam who's in Yemen now.
Right.
And so that becomes another kind of issue. Are these people going to be carrying out terrorist actions, or are they going to be carrying out lunatic actions that get rolled together with the idea of terrorism in everyone's mind?
If we can define a tactic involving lone wolves in some way, you know, it seems to me that the upside of this, as horrible as the Fort Hood casualties were, as horrible as the casualties in the train attacks in Madrid and Britain were, they're certainly significantly lower than a 9/11 style attack.
Well, that's right. Your categorization was right a few minutes ago. Those big attacks, it will be very unlikely that we will see anything like 9/11 again.
You're comfortable with that?
I'm absolutely comfortable saying that. Is it possible? Yes. Is it likely? No. If that had been the question that Dianne Feinstein had asked, everybody would have said, don't think it's likely. Hmm. But what we are worried about, what people are worried about, are lower scale attacks like Madrid, like the London subway attacks, or like Mumbai. If you look at the guns and the arms that the attackers were carrying in Mumbai, you can go to Georgia any day of the week and buy those things.
Georgia, not the Caucasus.
Not in the Caucasus. No, I mean Atlanta.
Suburbs of Atlanta. If someone at the NYPD, an organization, counterterrorist organization you've covered, was asked Dianne Feinstein's question, what do you think they would say before we go?
They would say, absolutely, there will be attempts. Absolutely. But probably not successful ones.
All right. Christopher Dickey is the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. He's the author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterrorism Force, the NYPD, which comes out in paperback this month. Coming up, we speak to an author who describes her creative process as she attempts to memorialize the friends and family she's lost in the Haitian earthquake. That's later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And Celeste, you know, after the program, I'm really busy today because I have to go up to Central Park and mow the lawn. I have a little part of the lawn up there that I'm responsible for mowing.
Yeah,
in Central Park here in New York. Budget cuts, of course, have changed all the services. Then I've got to stand a guard tonight with a flashlight because they've turned off some of the street
lights.
That's
going to be rough with your schedule.
Yeah, I'm going to have my flashlight there and just keep the street lit. This is not silly, what I'm talking about. It's actually an approach to budget cutting in the city of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Joining us now is the mayor of Colorado Springs, Lionel Rivera. Vera, good morning.
Good morning, John and Celeste. How are you?
So to deal with a shortfall, actually, we're doing fine. I'm a little worried about you because to deal with this shortfall in the budget, you've turned off some street lights. You've decided to stop maintaining some city parks, closing pools and museums, and hoping that the citizens can take up the slack. There's some good to this plan, but it feels a little draconian to me. How are you doing there in Colorado Springs?
Well, we're doing just fine, but you know, one of the things about local government, you can only spend what comes in tax revenues. We're not like the federal government who can turn on the printing presses and issue debt for day-to-day operations. And one thing we're blessed with in our community is tremendous volunteers, and we do have lots of volunteers who have different organizations that volunteer at our museum, at our parks, and in terms of the streetlights. So we're being very diligent in determining which ones are safe to turn off to save the electricity costs and maintenance costs for running those.
Now, in theory, you could buy some sort of computer software that would turn off streetlights where nobody's moving. You know, you could use motion detectors and do that. So that doesn't necessarily sound like a bad idea. But to keep streetlights off as a matter of course, more or less permanently, I mean, there is a safety issue there, don't you think?
Well, you know, it really depends on where you elect to turn those off. We actually have many neighborhoods in our community that ask us not to have street lights because they're on the mountainside. They like to view the night lights, and they would prefer not even to have street lights in those areas. We're going to be very careful and make sure we have street lights there in school areas, hospitals, major intersections. So, like I said, we're being very diligent and looking at the ones that will be turned off.
And turning off lights could potentially save you more than $1 million. I was looking at some of the math that you're doing. There's not much need for mowing lawns in the parks in Colorado Springs this time of year. But has anyone signed up to do serious maintenance at some of the public parks and museums?
Well, you know, that's still an ongoing process, so I can't really tell you where we are in terms of neighborhoods adopting parks. But if you want to call me later on in the early spring, I can give you an update.
And you probably could give me some jobs to do, it sounds like, too.
Sure. You can come spend some time here in Colorado Springs and volunteer in our parks, volunteer at our museum. We have plenty of things for you to do.
Now, Lionel Rivera, mayor of Colorado Springs, Colorado, what political risk are you taking with a program like this?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
What political risk are you taking? I mean, voters might say, you know, this is a ridiculous idea.
Well, voters had an option back in November to raise property tax. We did put that on the ballot, give them a choice, and basically explain that if we didn't have additional revenue, these are the kind of measures that we are going to have to take. I'm sure there are going to be constituents that are upset, but most folks believe that we should be focusing our monies on police and fire, public safety, roads, critical projects, and I think they understand the dilemma we're in, and we're hoping the economy turns around and we'll be able to put these things back in place.
And in theory, if they voted down the tax increase, they know what the issue is at this point. Lionel Rivera is the mayor of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Thanks so much, Mayor.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we speak to an author who is using her creative energy to deal with her grief and to memorialize the people that she lost during the Haiti earthquake. That's later in this hour. First, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. A new government estimate says healthcare spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. Almost $2.5 trillion federal dollars were spent on healthcare in 2009. That's $134 billion more than the year before. Yesterday, at a meeting with Democrats, President Obama expressed frustration with the stalled healthcare legislation.
Now, if the Republicans say that they can ensure every American for free, which is what was claimed the other day at no cost, I want to know. Because I told them, I said, why would I want to get a bunch of lumps on my head doing the hard thing if you've got the easy thing?
President told Democrats to finish the job on health care. Moving on to Toyota, the Washington Post says federal regulators have uncovered evidence that some Toyota cars have been having gas pedal problems as far back as 2007. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with investigative reporter Ken Bensinger from the LA Times. He says Toyota cut corners on their way to the top.
When you get really big, to do that, you have to make some sacrifices. And some people are saying, well, quality was what was sacrificed.
Earlier this morning, the company announced design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the 2010 Prius.
In Haiti, aid groups are shifting tactics when it comes to shelter for earthquake survivors. They now say Haitians should stop using tents in favor of do-it-yourself housing using waterproofed canvas, followed later by lumber. It's because it could take 5 years before most people are moved back into houses. Finally, here in the U.S., Republican Scott Brown will be sworn in this afternoon as this nation's newest senator, and he's the junior senator from Massachusetts. Although he's taking over for the late Ted Kennedy, the former senior senator, he won't be taking his desk. An aide says Senator John Kerry, now the senior senator from Massachusetts, is claiming that mahogany desk on the Senate floor used by Ted Kennedy for 47 years. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Good morning. South Floridians have been hearing The Takeaway for the first time this week, and we're here to welcome Miami and South Florida's WLRN to The Takeaway family. Of course, the disaster in Haiti has been on front page news in South Florida since the earthquake hit. Alicia Zuckerman, a senior producer at WLRN and co-host of the show Under the Sun, has been following the aftershocks of this new temporary policy to provide protective status for Haitian immigrants living in South Florida. Alicia, you recently went to an information session that was held for people interested in applying for this program that's called TPS. How many people were there?
There were, to be exact, 1,312, according to immigration.
Well, that's an exact number.
Yeah, I know that because they were expecting, they said they had something in the neighborhood of 800 information packets, and they came up short. They were not expecting that many people to show up.
Well, not everyone seemed to be happy with the process. You spoke with someone who was already a U.S. citizen, but had trouble getting status for his mother.
My mother was here for 16 years. We, all of us, our four brothers, we are U.S. citizens. And we applied for her because there was a mistake on her name. They denied her. She told me, hey, I can't make it. I have to bring her back. And then 3 months ago, I bring her back. Guess what? If she was here now, she would be qualified under TPS.
You also talked to somebody whose TPS application was delayed or denied because of a misspelled name. Was there a lot of these kind of complaints?
Well, there weren't, you know, a lot of the session actually was held in Creole, so I imagine there were a lot more than I heard, but you know, this was something that the Haitian TPS, temporary protected status, is something that the Haitian community in the United States has wanted for a long, long time. But obviously they didn't want it like this. You know, this is the most devastating thing that could have happened, the most devastating way to get TPS. But the tone was, I think, more somber than it would have been 2 weeks earlier. But people were really still people were sort of grateful to the government. They were saying this is what they've needed all along, and now they need it obviously more than they've ever needed it before.
Okay, thanks, Alicia. Alicia Zuckerman is co-host of the WLRN show Under the Sun. Let's now turn to one of Miami's most prominent Haitian Americans to talk about the position she holds as an artist, an artist in the public eye in the face of a huge public and private disaster. Adwige Dantaka is an author of novels Breath, Eyes, Memory, and The Farming of Bones. Good morning.
Good morning, and welcome to South Florida.
Thanks. Thanks very much. You know, you have not returned to Haiti since the earthquake, as I understand.
No, I haven't returned yet, but I hope to at some point very soon.
But you've gotten news of everyone? Everyone has been accounted for among your family and friends?
Well, like everybody else, we waited for a long time, but I finally, at some point, got news. We lost four people, but as I've been saying, we have more with us than not with us, so, which is more than a lot of people can say. It's been an enormous tragedy for this community, for all of Haiti.
You know, you're an author, you're an artist, and so you have decided to kind of memorialize not only your friends and family, but all those who suffered through the earthquake through your art. Can you tell me why you feel like you need to work through this in your public art, your private grief?
Well, I think everybody now feels a sense of helplessness if you're here and you're looking for something to do, and your first instinct is to do what you do in your everyday life. And for me, that's writing. And so this has been the way that I've been able to participate collectively and by writing about what I'm observing, what I'm hearing, and by lending my voice to speak along with other people. So art, I think art is witness. Art, I've never believed in art just for art's sake. I think it should serve a purpose, and there's no greater purpose at this moment to contribute whatever talent or gift one has to than this.
How's it working specifically? Are you taking notes on things? Are you watching news reports? How are you actually going through this to try and turn this incident into a piece of writing?
Well, first of all, this is not my primary purpose to be writing about this. I mean, there's on a daily basis, you know, we are getting, you know, you get real calls with people saying, I'm hungry, I'm sick, I'm, you know, family members, people we know very well. So I'm not sitting around thinking, oh, how do I make art out of that? You know, we're dealing first with very real things. But in a way, as a kind of, you know, outlet, and as a way of also bringing attention to these things, and, you know, again, as I said, joining the collective. So I write, you know, the things that I've written. I do things like your program. And I also, you know, just on personally, like I've been going through photos of the people we've lost and trying to remember things about them, just, you know, for the children, for people here, the kids here who may never know them.
Adwige Dantaka, a Miami-based author, you know, you participated in a photojournalism project that was produced by a couple other artists. You wrote an essay that was paired with two photographs, and in this, they pair the writing with one photo from Haiti and one from Cuba. In yours, your essay is paired with a photograph of a man standing up against the backdrop of a large, striking wrought iron gate. What was the significance of that photo with your essay?
Well, I was very lucky to, with Call Just and the Iris Collective, to be part of this project, because here in Miami, you know, we have such a large Cuban and a large Haitian community, and sometimes there's the bridges are not all fully together there. That photograph was a show of daily life in Haiti before this quake, and I think this book is going to be so much more important in other projects like that shows collaboration rather than destruction. And when I look at these photographs now, it seems almost another Haiti than the one that we're seeing. So So all these things become almost historical documents now for us, and all the love and joining that we're seeing on the ground with all other, you know, with our Cuban and Dominican and other neighbors, it's just an extraordinary document to that.
Okay, Edwige Dantakal, Miami-based author, recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. Thank you so much. She joined us from Miami.
That book that Celeste was talking about there, that they both were talking about, Book of Photos, you can see some striking photography from that book on our website, thetakeaway.org. Later today, the Tea Party Convention, have you heard of them, is kicking off in Nashville in hopes of starting a third political party. We've been asking you guys, if you were going to start a third political party in our country, what would your platform be? On our website, Ed posted that he would call his party the Pro-Life Party, and it would defend human life from conception to natural death. What's your take? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Tomorrow's Friday, we're going to be looking at who had a good week and a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. Would you like to nominate someone? You can also give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post that on our site, thetakeaway.org.
And your takeaway is from Jim Tomalczyk, who, a Tea Party organizer, explained why he's sitting out today's Tea Party conference in Nashville, Tennessee. You can go to our website and hear it. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.